and welcome to King's Inapley's podcast on the topic of the modern workplace, keeping up with a cultural shift. This podcast captures the content of our employment team's most recent breakfast briefing. Speaking at the seminar were our own specialist lawyers, Adam Lambert and James Murray, and we were also extremely fortunate to have Sibylle Raphael with us, who is the head of legal advice services at Working Families. We are happy to welcome her here now for a summary of what was covered. So hello and thank you to all of you for taking part in today's podcast. We'll start off with you, James. James, you started off by talking about the explosions of app usage over the past 10 years and the issues this can ensue for HR professionals. Can you talk me through some of the most common issues this can cause and how organisations can best deal with them?
Of course, thank you, Rebecca. I think there's a particular HR risk from social messaging apps such as WhatsApp, which are now incredibly widely used. On the one hand, employers face risks from tech-savvy employees who know, or think they know, how to hide their own misconduct. And on the other, from employees who may not realise the risks of the mediums they are using in order to communicate confidential business information. For example, these apps can make it difficult to monitor employees' communications. In particular, end-to-end encryption can make it hard to discover or evidence misconduct. For example, the misappropriation of confidential information, the planning of team moves, etc. For example, if the WhatsApp application is wiped on the device, it can be all but impossible to recover the data which it contained. Compare that to email servers, which will generally have a like-for-like backup, which only IT has the ability to delete. We also have the problem of indiscreet messages. There is an understandable tendency when using apps more suited to social contexts to put less considered thought into, say, a WhatsApp message than a formal email which you would write while sat at the desk in your office. This can have serious ramifications in various contexts. For example, in the context of a disciplinary between managers and HR, where there is no benefit of legal privilege because lawyers are not involved in the correspondence. These messages will still be disclosable, and ill-chosen words could destroy your defence if an unfair dismissal claim is brought. As well as being disclosable in any litigation, those messages can come out in the context of data subject access requests. The other example is during termination discussions, which you may want to be without prejudice or otherwise protected. The quickness and informality of messenger apps could blur the lines and potentially undermine such protection. The obvious solution to this is to block and discourage the use of apps in the workplace, such as WhatsApp. Your IT department should have total oversight and access to all work-related IT systems so they can manage users and their accounts, which includes immediately removing access to company accounts and data when employees are suspended or terminated. You can also consider a bespoke app store for work devices, which only allows employees to download business-friendly and secure apps.
You also talked about the role social media now plays in the modern workplace. For example, when employees post derogatory statements about colleagues or their work environment on their personal social media platforms. In order to take action against an employee in this situation, would the organisation need to have a robust policy in place against such behaviour, or can it just be put down to common sense?
Every organisation should put in place a pragmatic and enforceable social media policy which allows it to minimise the risks associated with employees' use of social media. And it does this by proactively defining acceptable and unacceptable uses in the context of the working relationship. It should cover, for example, usage of social media in office hours. Your policy here should generally reflect your organisation's general approach to the use of personal devices, personal emailing and internet use, i.e. it should be banned entirely or restricted to reasonable use which does not interfere with work. If an official account is used and generally sanctioned by the employer, it can be helpful to require a disclaimer to be inserted on the relevant page that any views are personal to the account owner. The policy can also cover the use of social media by employees at any time, including outside office hours, and regardless of whether they use the employer's equipment to access the social media. However, disciplinary action for a breach of this policy outside office hours will only be justified where the breach results in some kind of real damage to the employer. For example, dissemination of confidential information, liability for discrimination, or reputational damage. You should also clearly prohibit the sending of confidential information via social media, and the making of derogatory or discriminating comments about the company, their colleagues, or their clients, whether or not those comments are made during working hours. This is particularly important, as you could be held vicariously liable for such comments, and a robust policy may aid in your defence. Finally, remember to prohibit the disclosing or otherwise misusing of personal data, and your policy needs to dovetail properly with any IT usage policy, communications policy, and any GDPR related policy and privacy notices.
Thank you very much, James. Now, Adam, you talk specifically about age discrimination and how it is a unique type of discrimination for employers. Can you talk us through why that is?
You have to make the distinction between direct discrimination and indirect discrimination. Perhaps I can do that with a couple of examples. If there was a job advertisement that said that the job was only open to people who were under 40, then that's directly discriminating against people on the grounds of their age if they're over 40. If you have a job advertisement that says you need 10 years experience to do the role, on the face of it, that seems okay, but it's indirect age discrimination because you will need to be above a particular age in order to have obtained 10 years experience. Now, the difference between those two is that if you're looking at other forms of discrimination, such as sex or race, indirect can be justified and therefore potentially be lawful by way of doing a balancing act between the business benefit of having that criterion and the discriminatory aspect of having it. So you do that balancing act, and that may make it lawful. The same applies with age discrimination, but also with age discrimination, direct discrimination can potentially be justified as well. So it may be that an employer is able to give a very good reason why the job is only open to people under 40. So that's what sets age discrimination apart from others. But I think what I should say at this point is that it's very difficult. There also needs to be a social benefit, a social policy behind having direct discrimination if you want it to be justified rather than it just being a business reason.
Okay. You also spoke specifically about employees reaching the age of 50 within the public sector and the unlawful activity surrounding redundancy and early retirement. Would you mind giving us an example of what this might look like and why we see it so often?
Of course. It's quite commonplace in the public sector to have a threshold age of 50 or around 50. And the importance of that age is that if somebody is made redundant after they've attained that age, it's a lot more expensive for the employer, because as well as getting the usual redundancy payments that we're familiar with, the employer may have to fund early retirement as well by making a substantial payment into a pension fund. And this is an expensive way. So as you can imagine, within the public sector, a lot of case law derives out of the use of this age. Now, on the face of it, the age, although it is direct discrimination, this threshold has been found to be lawful because there is a social policy behind it. But there is quite a fine distinction there. For example, if somebody has been selected for redundancy and they're 49, it's quite lawful to try and push through their redundancy before they reach their 50th birthday. Whereas if somebody is 49 and the employer decides to make them redundant for that reason, so because they're cheaper than they would be a year later, then that is unlawful. So you can see the fine distinction there that comes out of the case law.
Okay, well, I find it very interesting when you talked about unlawful wording pertaining to age that is used so often in job advertisements. Why is it, do you think, that despite this being illegal since 2006, it is still so prevalent?
I think there's two reasons. The first reason is that employers very often don't identify indirect age discrimination, so they don't see the problem with setting criteria that could cause discrimination. We had the example earlier of needing 10 years service for a particular job. They don't identify that as being an age issue. But then when you start asking, why does it have to be 10? Why would you turn down somebody with 8 or 9 years experience? Shouldn't they be more flexible? Only then do they start seeing the age issues that may come out of it. But I think there's a second reason as well, which is perhaps a bit more sinister, in that age discrimination, in my view, is still socially acceptable. Even though it's unlawful, people haven't really caught up yet. It doesn't have the same stigma or the same taboo attached to it that other forms of discrimination have.
Okay. You also talked about the casual use of derogatory age-related language, such as snowflakes or millennials. Are we progressing quickly enough in terms of tackling the seriousness of age discrimination? Or do you think that compared to other types of discrimination, it is sometimes glossed over or even ignored?
Well, the short answer is that we're not progressing quickly enough, and it is often glossed over or ignored. And when we talked about this at the presentation, I mentioned politicians who still regularly come out with ageist remarks about the more senior MPs in the House of Commons, and CEOs of airlines who will still boast about how their airline is better because its workforce is younger. So we still see that a lot. And you mentioned snowflakes and millennials, both of which are age-related terms. The term millennial dates back to the 1980s and was supposed to mean people who were due to leave school around about the turn of the century. But more recently, it's been expanded to cover a wider age range, and also it's had a degree of contempt, in a way, attached to it in many situations. And the term snowflake is a very recent term. It's only within the last decade or so that it's come out. And again, it's seen as a derogatory term. So even since we've had age discrimination laws come in, we've had derogatory age-related terms coming after that. So there's still a long way to go.
Yes. And finally, Adam, I'm sorry to ask, but in your opinion, how do you foresee Brexit impacting the age demographic of the workplace over the next 10 to 20 years?
Well, at the time of making this recording, you'd have to be very brave to have a firm view as to the impact that Brexit will have. One possibility relates to immigration, in that the average age of a migrant is lower than the average age of the working population as a whole. So immigration actually brings down the average age of the workforce overall. So if Brexit means that immigration will be reduced, then that may have a slight impact on the demographics of the workforce. But I think even if it doesn't, you know, independently from Brexit, we're going to see changes. People are working until a later age because they can't afford to retire. People are living longer as well, which also affects the demographics. And fewer babies are being born. So the workforce is aging generally and will continue to age generally over the next 10 to 20 years. And I think that will have a bigger impact than Brexit.
Thanks. And finally, we turn to Sibyl from Working Families. Now, Sibyl, you spoke so eloquently and specifically about being a parent in the modern workplace. Thank you. And you started by talking about how in the mid-1980s, around 50% of the public would have agreed that a man's job was to earn money and a woman's job was to be a homemaker. Now, if we fast forward over 30 years later, only 13% of the public now subscribe to that view. Do you think the workplace has kept up with changing social attitudes, or do you think it's still somewhat stuck in the past?
I fear we are somewhat stuck in the past, at least in the workplace. Women in their 20s have seen the pay gap halve to 5%, but the discrepancy compared with men's earning widens when they hit 30 and start a family. The gender pay gap only properly takes off when women become mother. Childcare responsibilities is the real culprit. And what we see more generally is that workplaces are still comfortable with traditional gender assumptions about working and caring. Culture is actually more important than policy.
Right. And if we look at overtime, it's been reported that 72% of working parents are actually doing extra hours at work in the evenings or at the weekends. What impact does this have on working individuals and their family lives? And why is it in the best interest of an organisation to support a healthy work-life balance for their employees?
Working Families does an annual survey of how working families are managing the combination of work and family life. It's called the Modern Families Index. This year's survey found that what needs to change for them to better manage the balance between work and care viewed through the lens of their employment is a range of issues. It showed us that half of parents agree that their work-life balance is increasingly a source of stress. More than half of working parents feel burnt out and work is the cause. Less than half of parents feel flexible working is a genuine option in their workplace. Manager expectation, culture, and the importance attached to long hours make it difficult to combine caring and working, whilst work organisation mean that for many people, this is a barrier itself. Workload is too big for the time allocated to them. So what we see is that a parenthood penalty emerges, and the effects are not only damaging for the individual, of course. For businesses, a lack of work-life balance and family-friendly working can really harm recruitment and retention, as well as blocking up the talent pipeline.
That's really interesting, and I suppose following on for that, my next question must be, what simple steps can an organisation take to support working parents?
When we ask what can employers do to support work-life balance, the most frequently cited response from working parents was make efforts to change the company culture so work-life balance is more acceptable. Parents highlighted the lack of control over their working lives, and flexibility is a key tool for gaining control. Those parents who had access to flexible working practices reported higher levels of control than those who did not. But although on paper flexible working is widely available, the reality is that for many parents it's not a realistic option. It's the policy/practice gap. So we at Working Family campaign for all jobs to be advertised as flexible by default, using our Happy to Talk Flexible Working slogan. And we encourage employers to think about job design prior to advertising and widen the pool of talent for recruitment to those parents and carers who need flexible hours to balance their work and care. We provide training and consultancy, encouraging best practice. We reward innovation with our annual Top Employer for Working Families Award. And we also run a very successful benchmarking exercise so that employers can consider their internal policies against best practice similar organisations have in their sectors.
Sounds really good, thank you. Now, I remember you saying that the workplace can be tougher on working fathers than on working mothers, and you called that the fatherhood penalty. Why do you think this is?
Well, what we found is that the use of flexibility is very gendered. 11% of fathers work part-time, compared this to 42% of mothers. Fathers are twice as likely as mothers to believe that flexible working will harm their careers. And 34% of parents fake being sick to meet family obligations, but this rises to 40% of fathers. 40% would not be confident asking their employers about boundaries around work. Why? Well, women are allowed permission to work flexibly, to combine work and care, but fathers in the workplace must negotiate. They need to create a story to gain permission. The main responsibility for children is still considered to be held by women, regardless of working hours. And men are unwilling to have difficult conversations about limiting working time and work contact. So yes, we've started to see a fatherhood penalty.
And finally, you set out some clear recommendations for us regarding what changes we could make as a society to improve the workplace to better support working parents. What needs to change legally, and what do you think needs to change culturally?
We believe that legal change can help kickstart culture change, so we campaign for better independent rights for fathers. And sufficient pay is crucial to encourage fathers to take leave around childbirth and in the first year. The current levels of paternity and shared parental pay are not sufficient to ensure that all fathers use it. In the current workplace, staying in the same job for years is increasingly rare, and more parents are choosing to become, or in far too many instances being forced to become, self-employed. Current eligibility criteria around length of service and employment status are outdated, so we want to normalise parental rights, make them day one rights, and make them available to self-employed. We also campaign for family responsibility or carer to become a protected character seeking discrimination law. And we want a meaningful dialogue on flexible working, so give some teeth to the right to request flexible working. in terms of culture, what we want to change is see is that flexible working on its own is not enough, so we want a proper family-friendly workplace culture. We believe in the nudge theory, so we think that maybe extending the gender pay gap purporting to record retention rate of new parents could be a good idea, and we believe in increasing commitment, retention of talent, productivity, loyalty and creativity. So make flexible working and family-friendly working culture actually see as productive and good for businesses.
Thank you, Sibyl. And thank you, everyone. That was really interesting. The Kingsley Napoli employment team regularly provides breakfast briefings, events and training on issues such as these, which can provide useful information on topical issues for HR professionals. To find out more about this, please do join our mailing list by emailing events@kingsleynapoli.co.uk.